A reading from the Gospel of John, Gospel of Matthew, chapter 5, is the story of the Beatitudes. And seeing the multitudes, Jesus went up on a mountain. And when he was seated, his disciples came to him. Then he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God." Here ends the reading. Well, good morning. How wonderful it is to be back with you all here. Thanks for your kind invitation. I'm always grateful when I'm in your orbit here. A wonderful, wonderful community of love and encouragement and support while keeping your eyes on justice and the movements of the wider world. I hadn't heard that verse in Peace in My Heart, the first song we sang before. I have teardrops in my soul. I thought, how appropriate and compelling for today. Teardrops like raindrops watering our gardens this time of year. I watch the weather, especially now that our tomatoes have gotten just so, eager to see the raindrops that will come and nourish them. Teardrops also quenching the thirst of our souls, opening our hearts, allowing us to walk through the pathway of grief, which is vital for every one of us. Prechtel said that unresolved grief is the source of all wars. I've been thinking about that for a long time. So, 72 years ago today, the U.S. became the first and only country to date to employ atomic weapons in warfare. A B-29 aircraft bomber called the Enola Gay, which was named for the pilot's mother, Enola Gay Tibbetts, the pilot was Colonel Paul Tibbetts, dropped the equivalent of 16 kilotons of dynamite on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. The city was destroyed with immediate casualties numbering over 80,000, with an additional 35,000 severely injured, and by the end of the year, another 60,000 dead. The Enola Gay took off that morning to great fanfare. Officials wanted to record the mission for posterity. The Enola Gay returned 12 hours later. Several hundred people, including journalists and photographers, gathered to greet the plane's return. Colonel Tibbetts, the first to disembark from the plane, was immediately presented with the Distinguished Service Cross for his heroic efforts. The Distinguished Service Cross. The Enola Gay. 3 days later, Major General Charles W. Sweeney, the pilot of the bomber Boxcar, spelled B-O-C-K-S-C-A-R, dropped the next bomb, killing 40,000 upon detonation, with another 35,000 dying soon thereafter. Both pilots, Tibbett and Sweeney, would defend to their deathbed what they saw as the appropriateness of their cause and the rightness of their actions. The bomb's chief architect, however, Robert Oppenheimer, was the physicist and the leader of the Manhattan Project, and he was present, of course, for the first atomic detonation, the trial run, which happened on July 16, 1945, in the New Mexico desert at a test site called Trinity. He was watching the blast that day and the ensuing mushroom cloud over that New Mexican desert. He recalled the words of Vishnu in the Bhagavad Gita, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." The novelist Nora Gallagher, who was for a period of time interested and in the process to become an Episcopal priest, I don't know if you know that about her, but she has an affinity with faith communities. She wrote a novel called Changing Light, a novel. And it's the backstory about the detonation of the bomb in the New Mexican desert in 1945. I won't go into the novel, but in the novel she gives voice to a Japanese girl who survives the bombing and asks this question: "Those men who built the bomb, what did they think would happen if they dropped it? What did they think would happen if they dropped it?" We've been given a lot of reasons why America dropped the bomb in Hiroshima: to end the war, to save American lives. And these are factually true, of course. Hiroshima did end the war, and it did save American lives. A land invasion and a ground war in Japan would have created enormous casualties. But many other facts have since come out. One is that the Soviet Union was preparing to invade Japan on August 14th from the north. Dropping bombs in this way of thinking put Russia on notice, and what resulted was a chilling period of history that we now know as the Cold War. We also know now that the Japanese, as it turns out, were exploring conditional surrender, even as our target team was considering a list of cities on which the first atom bomb would be dropped. They wanted to find a city that had not been destroyed by the firebombing of the war so they could see just how well the atom bomb worked. In an interview a few years before he died, Colonel Tibbetts said Hiroshima and Nagasaki presented ideal virgin targets, a classroom example, if you will, from which to assess the power and destructive capacity of the new weapons. Prior to the dropping of the bombs, 150 scientists working with the Manhattan Project wrote a letter petitioning President Truman not to drop the bombs. 20 years later, in 1965, when an interviewer asked the director of the Manhattan Project, Oppenheimer, what he thought about President Johnson's proposal to initiate talks with the Soviet Union to halt nuclear proliferation, Oppenheimer replied, "It's 20 years too late. It should have been done the day after Trinity, the day after the experimental bomb was tested in July 1945 in New Mexico, weeks before Hiroshima and Nagasaki were devastated." Since that time, we have become, I wouldn't say comfortable, but aware of the presence of nuclear power in our presence. I grew up in Gaffney, South Carolina, not far from here, and it's one of the sites of Duke Power's nuclear ambitions. A plant was in creation there that, thank God, has never been fully developed and activated. But the containment vessel for the reactor chamber was used by the film director James Cameron to shoot the underwater scenes of that blockbuster in 1987, The Abyss. Anyone seen that? And although I didn't really know that much about it, I discovered that my father, for a period of time, worked at the Savannah River plant, where nuclear materials were refined for use in nuclear weapons. It was, as I heard them say, my family say, a good paying job. The Savannah River plant, as you know, is in Aiken, South Carolina. It's also known as the bomb plant, or as we pronounce it in Gaffney, the bum plant. How many of you have protested there? God bless you. Thank you. In high school, as the squadron commander of ROTC, I was recruited by the Navy pretty heavily to consider a scholarship in college and working with the nuclear power program of the Navy. My senior science project, however, was in passive solar energy and passive solar homes, so I only had a passing interest in what he had to say. I had a friend, Frankie, who actually went forward with this and had from what I could tell, had a great career, retiring just a couple of years ago from the Coast Guard. And although it was before my time, many of us here will remember the classroom drills of the Cold War, duck and cover, bomb drills, fallout shelters. And who can forget that bone-chilling advertisement that only aired one time in the 1964 presidential campaign, the ad by President Johnson saying that the stakes are just too high to risk electing Goldwater. Can't you hear her now, that little girl, as she counts the petals on that daisy? While in the background you hear the countdown of someone announcing the detonation, and then you hear the explosion, you see the mushroom cloud. Yikes, this is horrible stuff. Speaking of Armageddon, which that seemed to indicate, did you know that there is an amazing collection of digital files available on the internet by the Balsillie School of International Affairs in Waterloo, Ontario, a file of letters called the Armageddon Letters, and it's about the Cuban Missile Crisis. I shudder to think of how close we came to nuclear holocaust. And you hear the stories of, you know, if this had happened or if that had happened. And I also shudder to think what it would be like if a crisis of that level were to face us today. According to the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, in the mid-1980s, the world reached a high of 70,000 nuclear weapons, with more than 95% of them in the arsenals of the United States and the Soviet Union. Since then, the number has fallen to under 15,000, so we've made significant progress. But we still have enough weapons to make the rubble bounce, some folks have calculated, at least 11 times. And that's 11 times too many. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists on the doomsday clock have now stated that we are just 2.5 minutes before midnight. This is pretty somber stuff, I know. Nora Gallagher, let's go back to her. She has a question. She says, so what happened to us as a nation on August 6th, 1945, 72 years ago to this very day? How did Hiroshima erode our sense of morality, what we permit ourselves as a nation to do? How did it affect our fragile sense of what is permissible for one human being to do to another human being? Did the use of a weapon designed to ruthlessly annihilate whole cities contribute to where we find ourselves today? And finally, what is that line of connection between Hiroshima and Vietnam, between Hiroshima and Iraq, from Hiroshima to Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib? A few days after the bombs were dropped in 1945, reporters sought out the peace activist, world-renowned person, Gandhi, and asked for his reaction. He replied, "The atomic bomb resulted for a time being in destroying the soul of Japan. What has happened to the soul of the destroying nation is yet too early to see." Violence begets violence, begets violence, begets violence. All of this leads us to the question, and the real point of the talk today, is how are we to be peacemakers in this nuclear age? What does it mean to be a peacemaker? There are so many cliches and memes. Give peace a chance. Make love, not war. And I saw a t-shirt in the wireless catalog a few years back. I thought it was kind of funny. Whirled peas. It had peas in a blender being whirled around. these cliches are easy to dismiss. How do we get traction in advancing the cause of peace in the world? That's the meat of what we are here to talk about and explore today. According to Charles Eisenstein, do you guys know Charles Eisenstein? He's a writer, a really incredible author, a visionary. He lives in Asheville now. I mean, he travels all over the world. He says that we have to embrace a new story. Eisenstein talks about our time as being a time between stories. The old story of dominion and power and violence doesn't work if we want to build a future founded upon the pursuit of peace in the world. In his inspiring book, the title of which, in my opinion, says it all, the title being, "The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible," he talks about that time between stories and moving from the old story to the new story, giving up the old story of duality, domination, winners and losers, and to embrace the new story that is emerging, unitive, non-dual, cooperative, grounded in love and collegiality and cooperation. What Bishop Tutu calls Ubuntu, Ubuntu meaning, Swahili word meaning, I am because you are. You see, when we bomb Nagasaki and Hiroshima, when we bomb Syria, when we bomb Iraq, we're bombing ourselves because we are related. So how do we live into and write this story? Well, there's a peace educator that I've recently discovered. His name is Paul Chappell. He's a West Point educated Iraq war veteran turned peace advocate. There's a mouthful. And he says we need to become literate in peacemaking. Paul founded an organization called the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. He's published several curricula to teach peacemaking in the nuclear age. He's a person of hope. He gets excited talking about the myriad ways humans have changed their minds about certain things. For example, slavery. Less than 200 years ago, it was far from unanimous that slavery was evil. Less than 100 years ago, was it that women finally were given the right to vote with Amendment 19. The civil rights movement of the 60s expanded significant freedoms for African Americans, and although we still have a ways to go. The list goes on, equality for LGBTQ folks and transgender folks, women in military. Even though these things are under assault right now, this is a passing moment. This is not the end. The point is that if we are educated, we have the capacity to change our minds. We have learned so much since 1945. Becoming literate in peacemaking helps us author and actualize this new story, this more beautiful world that our hearts know by intuition is possible. We do this not only by studying the biographies of great peacemakers like King and Gandhi, but by studying also the incredible developments in peacemaking strategies, such as nonviolent social communication, appreciative inquiry, community organizing. We do this by studying the impact and the implications of neuroscience on peacemaking in the world. It is good for us, for our bodies, to choose the path of forgiveness and not retaliation. To understand that meditation is good for body and soul. To understand that movements and resilience and sustainability and the sharing economy not only preserve our lives, but they also make us happier. When I first moved to the area a few years back, I remember hearing about an initiative, I think of the United Religions Initiative, called Peace Academy, maybe, where they had gatherings to teach folk these new developments. Maybe we need to return to that. Maybe we need to have folks offering workshops in nonviolent communication strategy and offering workshops in community organizing, offering workshops in resistance. The greatest irony, I think, of the Trump administration is that in a way that he would never see as good, he is in some way, in fact, making America great again on some level because we, the people, are rising up in resistance against him and taking back our democracy. And we do this successfully, not by revolution, but with a heart-centered re-love-olution. Let's change the words around, just the letters around just a little bit. A re-love-olution that has as its rallying cry, love wins. And as Reverend Barber says, if love isn't winning, we haven't gotten to the end of the story yet, so don't give up hope. Last night in Hiroshima, the World Peace Prayer Society and other groups held a peace commemoration and prayer vigil at the Peace Museum in Hiroshima, a museum that features the works of the beautiful poet that Carol read from this morning. In the museum is the Children's Peace Monument, honoring thousands of children killed. The monument is adorned with cranes upon cranes upon cranes, the peace cranes, and engraved at the base of the memorial are these words, "This is our cry, this is our prayer, peace in the world." We owe it to the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and Vietnam and Iraq and Syria to become literate in the ways of peacemaking, so that we may write and courageously embrace the new story of peace in our time. That's the world that Jesus spoke about in the Beatitudes, a reversal of the story of domination and power makes right. Jesus talks about a place where the meek, not the powerful, but the meek will inherit the earth. And there is reason for hope. Just a few weeks ago, if you remember, the United Nations passed an ambitious treaty banning nuclear weapons. It's signed by almost every country on the planet, 122 in favor, one opposed, and one abstaining. The U.S., however, refused to participate in the voting, so our vote wasn't registered one way or the other. We are boycotting the resolution and not voting because of the growing danger of the nuclear ambitions of North Korea. You could fill in the blank if that wasn't the case, and there'd be some other reason not to do it, I'm sure. But steadfast in her convictions, a woman named Beatrice Finn at the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, headquartered in Geneva, declared, "It's a prohibition in line with other prohibitions on weapons of mass destruction. We banned biological weapons 20 years ago. We banned biological weapons 45 years ago, chemical weapons 25 years ago, and today we are banning nuclear weapons." The treaty now goes out to be ratified by member nations. Within 2 years, the treaty could have the 50 state ratifications that it needs to become international law. And if this happens, any use of nuclear weaponry could be tried as a war crime. So Maria and I just got back from my fiance, Maria. So happy she's here with me. How lucky am I? We just got back from a cultural exchange and a peacemaking mission in Palestine, and that's a whole nother story. But while we were there, the group that we were with, the Amos Trust from London, the guy leading the pilgrimage that we were on shared from a novel that's recently out by a man named Arundhati Roy. And the title of the novel is The God of Small Things. Maybe some of you are reading it, you've seen it, yeah. My favorite quotation from this book speaks to the topic today, and with this, I'll close. In his writing, Roy says, "Another world is not only possible, But she is on her way on a quiet day. I can hear her breathing. May it be so, and may peace prevail on earth. Thank you.